today's episode, the Dodgers call up two hot young prospects. Did Cody Bellinger and Julio Urias make all the difference for the National League West race? Who is the John Livingston Seagull of right-handed starting pitchers? Plus, the Mets' injury issues are perhaps contagious. The rest of the NL East is played with injuries from Aaron Nola to Adam Eaton to the Mets' own Yoenis Cespedes and Noah Syndergaard. It's the DFA Podcast. Welcome to the second episode of DFA, the podcast from Baseball's Prospectus covering all things transaction. I'm Brian Grosnick of Baseball Prospectus. Joining me, as always, my co-host, RJ Anderson of CBS Sports. RJ, how's it going?
It's going wonderfully, Brian. Thank you for asking.
Well, I'm glad to hear that things are going well for you. It seems like now that we've started this podcast, a lot of the news that we're going to be covering early in the season is all bad news. Like it's a lot of 10-day disabled list trips and things like that. And we'll have plenty of that kind of stuff to talk about today. But yeah, it seems like all the transactions early in the season are kind of sad. Like, oh, somebody got sent down or somebody gets DFA'd or somebody is going to the disabled list with another horrible injury. Are you feeling that way or am I just being super negative?
That's just regression to the mean. You know, everybody enters the season all happy and all, and this is the universe's way of humbling us all and reminding us that, nope, you're not going to be happy for very long. You're going to just have to learn to live in balance.
That's a little bit dark, too. So, good. We're on the same page. Very philosophical of you to take that tack. But, I would like to talk about something a little more fun and a little more happy. So, the big move for today on our second episode is going to be a pair of big moves. One of the teams that probably doesn't have this sense of ennui and melancholy is the Los Angeles Dodgers, because the Dodgers have called up two of the best players in the minor leagues over the last week. First, they've called up Cody Bellinger to replace Jock Peterson, who has gone to the disabled list like everyone does. And then in addition to bringing up Bellinger, who's one of the top offensive prospects possibly in baseball, in addition to Bellinger coming up, they've also brought up Julio Urias, who's back and in the rotation and pitching well. So since we haven't had a show for almost a week, we can talk a little bit about both these guys and not only their call-ups, but how well they've started. And I know you've been forced slash enjoyed watching the Dodgers over the weekend. So do you want to talk a little bit about Bellinger and what do you think he's going to do for the Dodgers?
Yeah, and as you know, when you're on the TAB, you don't necessarily get a chance to check out prospects. You know, instead of the top prospects, we have to spend a lot more of our energy and our time focusing on the fringe guys, the guys who are a sprained ankle or ERA away from reaching the majors. So this was one of my first times seeing Bellinger, and I was impressed, because when you look at him, he's this tall, lanky dude, and his swing is interesting because his front foot, you know, you're not supposed to land with your front foot open. You know, they call that stepping in the bucket. But he does that to clear his hips. And he just generates so much leverage in his swing. You can totally understand why scouts are thinking he has plus-plus power potential, because he's a huge dude. All that leverage in that swing, you know, the bat speed, you just can absolutely see why he can hit 30-plus home runs in the majors. And in addition to that, you can also see the athleticism there. And I think he's interesting. You know, when I was growing up, I always had a thing for like the multi-position guys, like Tyler Houston, who can catch and play third base, and Michael Barrett can do the same. And, you know, this was before I realized that if your catcher can play an upper position, that's probably a bad thing as it pertains to their catching. But, you know, so this roster, you know, we add Bellinger to Austin Barnes, who is one of those kind of players, as well as, you know, Enrique Hernandez and all the other versatile parts on here. And I'm really interested to see how they work him into the lineup consistently, whether they slot him into a corner outfield position or if they're just waiting on Adrian Gonzalez to require a DL stint because, you know, he's not been playing extremely well to begin the season or what have you. But I'm very interested to see what they do with Bellinger here over the next few months.
Yeah, I've going back to his swing a little bit, you mentioned how he steps in the bucket. I've also heard that from some talent evaluators that I respect, Jeff Paternostro and Craig Goldstein, that he's got a little bit of a long swing, which may hamper his hit tool over time. So, you know, he's got that incredible bat speed, but he still is a little bit long, and so that gives him a little bit of swing and miss, which, you know, with the new analytics bent, that it seems like people are more open to a little bit more swing and miss if it sells out for power. It doesn't seem like it would be too much of an issue, but so far the power has come, right? So Bellinger has 2 homers in 6 games, slugging percentage well over 500. So he looks like he looks the part right now. He's hitting well. He's playing decent enough defense, moving around the diamond a little bit. He looks like the type of player who could be a, you know, another impact young guy for this Dodgers team, who already has a host of impact young players, impact older players. I mean, things are looking pretty decent for the Dodgers from a lineup perspective right now, don't you think?
Yeah, and just to touch on what you said about Bellinger and his swing, you know, he starts really upright, and if you watch his hands, you know, what I would mention about his leverage, yeah, there is definitely length to that swing, and, you know, his strikeout rates have kind of flip-flopped throughout the minors. I think he's around 28% a couple years ago, and got that down to like 20% last year. So I'm very interested to see how much he does strike out in the majors. But yeah, this Dodgers lineup, you know, Grandal has had a good few days, I believe, and they do have some weak spots still. You know, Chase Utley has been horrible. Scott Van Slyke has not performed as they would like him to. But Andrew Toles continues to be a bright spot. You know, they found him for nothing. Of course, Friedman was familiar with him during their shared time in Tampa Bay, but yeah, statistically, this Dodgers lineup is, I believe, like 5th in true average and in the top half in runs scored. So this is not a situation like Boston or San Francisco or even Toronto where they're not performing well. It's just perhaps not performing as well as it could, which is a scary thought. You know, once if Utley gets going, you know, if Gonzalez gets going, this lineup can perform even better. So that's a scary thought if you're a fan of another National League West team, but it's a comforting thought if you're a Dodgers fan who's maybe a little disappointed with a 14-12 start. Because, you know, it seems like this team's best baseball is ahead of it rather than behind it. And I know it's weird to say that in May 1st, but it's true.
So, yeah, so the start of the new month, and, you know, the best baseball's ahead of them, you think, possibly. And so part of that, too, is Julio Urias coming back up and rejoining the rotation, maybe a little bit earlier than I would have guessed, given the Dodgers' propensity to protect him and his pitch counts. But Urias came up, made his first start of the season on Thursday, and pitched very well. I mean, he gave up only a couple of runs over his 5 2/3 innings worth of work, actually only gave up a single run. That was my mistake. And he looked sharp again. So Urias has this pedigree as a top-end prospect, another dangerous left-hander to slot into the Dodgers' rotation. People tend to be nervous about his workload, though, and his youth and his you know, potential to burn out as a starter before the end of the season. Are you excited about watching Urias, and do you think that the Dodgers have called him up too early, or is he in a good position to go forward and kind of balance this rotation out for the rest of the season, you think?
I'm fascinated by him because so much of what we do with our analysis and with our evaluation is based on precedent. And I can't find a precedent for this guy, you know, based on his age and based on the workload and all. I'm not quite sure what to make of that. You know, I don't know if he's going to be able to mature into that workload. I don't know if they've hindered him to some extent by, you know, treating him with kid gloves. So far as, you know, his present day impact, I think he's going to be fine, but I would note that he's now made 4 starts on the season and his walk rate has been up there. And I'm including his minor league starts, to be clear. I'm not saying just his major league starts, but yeah, he's walked more than you would like to see from a starting pitcher. So I'm curious to see if that's, you know, just a small sample size issue or perhaps a hint that something else is a little off. And you're right, the Dodgers, to their credit, you know, their rotation has mostly been healthy. I know Rich Hill is on the disabled list, but, you know, Brandon McCarthy has made all of his starts. You know, Ryu has made all of his starts. So I think they're fine. I think you're going to see him eventually go back down. But, yeah, I am very curious to see how they handle him, not just this year, but heading forward, because, again, I can't think of a precedent for what they're trying to do here.
Yeah, he's a really interesting guy. I like what you mentioned about the walk rate, because getting started this season, it hasn't looked the same as it had in the past. He's never had elite command in the minor leagues, but kind of he's always come up with this reputation as a kind of an old soul for a really young starter. Like he's been a smart pitcher. He has he kind of attacks the zone as if he was more of a veteran than a 20-year-old. Even when he was pitching in the low minors, they kind of thought that he had the mindset on the mound of a more veteran starter. His stuff is tremendous, but it's not the blow the doors off kind of stuff that you see on some of these other, you know, high profile pitching prospects. He was as much about, he was close to his ceiling as any other pitcher in the low minors, and it's continued to play up a little bit as he's come up to the majors. But you're right, the walk rate could be a little concerning. The fly ball rate can be a little concerning at times too. I mean, though there's a nice benefit to pitching in Chavez Ravine, and the Dodgers defense with Tolles and with Puig and with Bellinger in the outfield is actually probably pretty decent. It would be really interesting to me to see if the Dodgers ever get their something close to their ideal rotation all kind of clustered together at the same time. And if they do, will it be at the end of the season or in the playoffs when they need it the most? Or is there just going to kind of be like this 1 month period in like June or July where they manage to line up Kershaw and Hill and Urias? And or is it going to be something where they're going to just continue to have to play mix and match? And maybe at the end of the season, it's not going to be the three or four starters they really wanted who are lined up to pitch in the playoffs if they make it there.
My guess is it's not going to be the three or four starters who they want, because that never seems to be the case. And if it is the case, you know, maybe they are headed for the National League Championship Series against the Cubs or whomever their opponent might be at that point.
Yeah, the other thing is the Dodgers always have the capital to go out and get somebody at the trade deadline, where some other teams might. They still have a host of young talent. They still have some veteran players that they could move and not lose too much. I mean, that kind of depth that they have could lead them to be able to make a move later on, I suppose, as well, which could be interesting, because you kind of figured going into the season that you knew everybody who was going to make the top of the divisions in the league. And some of these teams that we kind of thought were definitely going to be contending, whether it's the Giants or the Mets or some of these other teams, may not be anywhere close to the playoff picture come the trade deadline season. So maybe you'll see a guy that's available to take a spot in the Dodgers rotation that we may not have expected to start the season.
Yep, that makes sense to me. And, you know, the Blue Jays, I would throw them in there as well, because I think we all expected them to be decent, and they have been the farthest thing from decent.
Yeah, that's been pretty ugly. It's probably a topic for another time, because, gosh, there's a lot to kind of delve there and figure out what the heck's going on there. But, yeah, you could easily see the guy from the Blue Jays that just jumps out at me is the way the Dodgers love their left-handers with strikeouts. You know, they could pick up a Francisco Liriano and not blink twice, probably for nothing near the deadline, and slot him in and just go all lefties all the way through the rotation. So let's kind of keep it rolling with pitching, move on to our second topic for the day. And this one's going to be a little bit more of a retrospective look than a transaction that's happened recently, although it affects us right now. And let's go ahead and talk a little bit about Andrew Triggs of the Oakland Athletics. Triggs is a really interesting guy, because the transaction that brought him to the Athletics, how do I put this? No one cared about when it happened. And no one thought it would be a big deal. It was just Andrew Triggs. And the Athletics are surprising a little bit this season. Triggs is certainly surprising. So, RJ, let's talk a little bit about Andrew Triggs, how he found his way to the Athletics, and why it actually matters in 2017, which we never thought might happen before.
Yeah, well, it all starts last March. Well, March of 2016 now, when the Athletics claimed Triggs off waivers from the Orioles. And at the time, Triggs was coming off his age 26 season. He had been a reliever in Double A for the Orioles affiliate. He had an outstanding strikeout rate and strikeout to walk ratio, 10.3 strikeouts per nine, 1.6 walks per nine. Hadn't allowed a single home run that season, but he had started like one game for his minor league career. So the A's bring him into the fold, and he eventually made it to the majors, made 24 appearances. Six of those were starts. You know, everybody's kind of like, eh, because when you watch Triggs, he does not look like a starting pitcher. Okay. Now, what I mean by that is not that he has a small stature or anything. He is a well-built fella, but he has a low arm slot. He has crossfire delivery where, I mean, he's heading toward the third base side. And, yeah, you don't think of him as a legitimate starting candidate for those reasons. Then you add in his velocity. I believe he tops out around, like, 91. I think that was, like, his highest reading last time out. But speaking of that last time out, he went out and he struck out 9 Houston Astros in his 5th start of the season, which was new career high. And here's the thing. He has started those 5 games, and 4 of those he has departed without allowing an earned run. Now, we all know that ERA and earned runs are not the best way to judge a pitcher's talent, but that's still impressive for someone who March of 2016 was available on a waiver claim. So what Triggs does, he pitches low in the zone with his sinker and his breaking balls. He gets a bunch of ground balls. He's usually a pitch-to-contact guy, but it's been very effective for him. And through 5 starts, he has a 1.84 ERA. He has a 3.67 strikeout-to-walk ratio. And in 85 and two-thirds innings in the majors now, he's allowed 6 home runs. That's a formula that is really working for him. So do we think he is a legitimate mid-rotation to back-rotation starter, or is this an instance where we're getting fooled by sample size because it's just 11 starts? It's not, you know, that's not a lot. Or, you know, what do you think here, Brian? Do you think he is a great find that he seems to be, or is this just the case where we're reading too much into a small sample?
Well, I mean, can it be both? I think it has to be a little bit of both. And you mentioned the 11 starts, the 85 some odd innings in the major leagues, and he's only given up 6 homers. That's really interesting. And we could call that kind of a small sample size thing. But in the minors, he's thrown 254 innings and he's given up 7 home runs. So this is not a guy who, you know, just has gotten lucky and not given up any homers in the majors. He gave up very few home runs in all of his time in the minors. Now, granted, almost all of it was as a reliever, but if you can limit home runs to the extent that he's able to, and pitching in Oakland, that's a little bit easier than pitching in some of the worst ballparks for home runs in the majors. I mean, even if you can't strike out more than, you know, maybe 6 per 9 or 7 per 9, that's extremely effective. And his walk rate has been pretty good as well. So you're right, pitch to contact kind of guy from a low arm slot. There's always a worry that a guy like that is going to get, quote, figured out, that teams will get past a little bit, that arm slot and the deception, especially when they have to see him 2 and 3 times a game. But his ability to avoid those big flies, if he can maintain that just a little bit and, you know, give up maybe 0.5 homers per 9 or something like that over his career, he could be a really effective middle or back of the rotation guy. I'm so surprised by this because, first of all, the Athletics claimed him off waivers from the Orioles. You think the Orioles could use a decent starter every now and then? You know, like, this is a team that really could not have afforded to give him up. They're running Logan Verrett out there now. It's just mystifying to me that a guy with such little starting experience could be moved from the bullpen to the rotation secretively, kind of, and have this kind of effect. I do worry that, you know, faced with big league hitters with this ultimate power, home run rates are skyrocketing around the league, and he still managed to maintain such a low home run rate. I wonder if that will eventually go away a little bit and he'll start giving up more homers. And if he does that, then he really looks like a back of the rotation option probably, or he'll get sent back into relief role. But for the time being, he's doing it. You mentioned his ERA being very low. His DRA is very low too, for what that's worth, his deserved run average. So it's not necessarily just that his ERA has been a lot of luck. He's been, according to at least Baseball Prospectus's measure, the runs allowed have been close to what he deserves. So I think you kind of got to let it ride for a little bit with Triggs. I think that he can probably maintain this to some extent, provided he doesn't lose any more velocity or the league doesn't come around and kind of really adjust to the way he's delivering the ball.
Yeah. And there's one more interesting thing I mentioned about him. You would expect him to have severe platoon splits, or I would expect him to have severe platoon splits where lefties are seeing him better and capitalizing upon that. But if you look at his numbers for his big league career, and, you know, these are, again, a small sample size. This does not mean they are predictive. It just means they're descriptive. He has a 656 OPS against righties and a 604 OPS against lefties. And again, that's in fewer than 200 plate appearances both ways. But that struck me as interesting because when you evaluate players, usually the lower the arm slot, the more the platoon advantage is beneficial to them. And same with the crossfire delivery. So, yeah, that's very interesting to me. And I guess I would just say Triggs as a whole is very interesting to me. And I'm curious to see if his pitch to contact, keep it down, keep it in the ballpark approach will hold up over the long haul. Oh, and the other interesting thing, I lied. There's two interesting things about him. He does not have a higher than normal double play percentage. What I mean by that is number of double plays divided by opportunities. I would have expected him to be over, I think it's like 11% is a league average, and he's around 10%. So that struck me as interesting because, you know, sometimes I think the most popular recent example was Joe Saunders. You know, he didn't have great peripherals, but when a guy got on first, he'd find a way to get a double play ball, and his ERA would stay low because of that. That's not the case with Triggs. He's not benefiting from an extreme ground ball, extreme double play rate here. Even though he has a very good ground ball rate, and even though he's done a good job of limiting the damage when he gives up contact. So two interesting factoids there about Andrew Triggs that you may not have otherwise known about or cared about, but that's what we deliver on this show.
Yeah, Triggs Facts, the Triggs Facts podcast. We can change our name to that. DFA, maybe the A stands for Andrew at this point.
Trigonometry.
The one other interesting thing I'll bring up, we have so many interesting things about Triggs in our back pockets, but his number two pitch has been a cutter off his sinker. And that's really interesting to me because, again, he used to be with the Orioles. The Orioles have that very strong anti-cutter philosophy. And his cutter being his secondary pitch off his sinker, I think that's really interesting that he's been throwing it and he's been throwing it well, with the exception of, I think, start 2 weeks ago, he said he had lost some feel for the cutter and he had a less successful start as a result for that. I kind of wonder if the change of teams has really benefited him from, you know, being able to develop that pitch a little bit more or to at least work on it a little bit, whereas I know with the Orioles, they're not fans at all of that particular pitch. So I wonder if the move made a difference and the Athletics might have been able to get something out of him that the Orioles never could have.
I would just add to that. Miguel Gonzalez is another former Orioles pitcher who has moved on to a different organization and who has taken to throwing his cutter more. And he's obviously had a very good deal of success with the White Sox. So there might be something to that.
Yeah. I mean, nobody likes the Orioles and how they handle their pitching staff at all, including, it sounds like, many of the pitchers on the Orioles. So let's see if there's ever any change for that. Although, you know, the way that they've been playing over the last couple of years, I don't think anything's going to change. They're performing too well to change anything, but I guess we'll have to see. But yeah, Triggs is great. It's always fun to see a guy who succeeds without doing the yawn, boring right-handed pitcher who throws 97 miles an hour and working off a fastball slider combo like you see in the bullpen and stuff. It's always kind of fun to see a guy who goes about things a little bit differently, uses a repertoire that's just a little bit different or a delivery that's a little different and has a great deal of success with it. I hope it continues, even though I have no particular affinity for the Athletics at this point.
Yeah, I like that he's challenging our beliefs about reality as it pertains. Well, yeah, he's challenging our beliefs about reality as it pertains to baseball and otherwise. I don't like having that feeling that we know what's going to happen. I don't like that feeling of certainty. I like being a little uncertain. I like being open to new possibilities, and I like being open to non-traditional success stories and non-traditional recipes for success. So keep doing you, Andrew Triggs. I am very much a fan.
Yeah, we'll be following along and seeing if anything changes over time. But
right now he's the Jonathan Livingston Siegel of right-handed pitchers right now. So do not conform, Andrew.
I love it. All right, so let's. There's a lot of smaller, maybe bigger moves, transactions. Guys who've hit the disabled list, coming off the disabled list. Lots of stuff going on this week. So we'll turn it over to Sean, the producer, and you're going to throw us some batting practice. Give us a couple of quick hits where we can talk about some of the other moves that of the past week.
A lot of smaller roster moves we have to cover this week, but the first one off the bat is probably one of the biggest blows to, I would argue, as the best lineup in the National League, and that is Adam Eaton to the disabled list with a torn ACL. Well, now we've all seen the video. We've all seen the sadness that comes with that. Eaton acquired in the offseason from the Chicago White Sox. So what does this mean for a Nationals lineup that was already strong and sent a lot away for him this offseason?
Well, it stinks for the Nationals for multiple reasons. Foremost, they're losing Eaton, who is a very productive player. Next, they have to insert Michael Taylor, who, despite being a former top prospect, has not shown he can hit big league pitching. I think his strikeout rate for his career is around 32-33%. He's a good defender, but that only goes so far, even when you're playing an up-the-middle position. And the last point here that should not be lost on anyone is the Nationals no longer have those prospects they traded for Eaton to go out and get a replacement. So they're getting hit on at least three fronts here. I don't know what their plan is here. I don't know if it's to ride it out until the deadline and see if Lorenzo Cain shakes loose or whomever, but it's a big blow to a very good team.
Yeah, I agree with you. I will say this. No other team has the kind of lead on the rest of the division that the Nationals have. With the Mets faltering and falling apart and having so many injuries of their own, the Nationals hold a five-game lead on every other team in their division, and things don't look great for the other four teams in that division. I would say more than any other team in baseball right now, they have the clearest path to at least the playoffs. The only problem there is that the Nationals, it doesn't seem to matter how clear of a path they get into the playoffs, they are terrible once they get there. And Eaton would have helped with that.
And they have bad luck here. I mean, Wilson Ramos getting hurt the last week of the regular season in 2016, and where with Steven Strasburg, wherever, it seems like they always suffer some kind of setback before they reach the postseason that then leads to a shorter stay in the postseason than they would have otherwise liked to have.
Absolutely. The one good thing about this is that the Nationals have a really good lineup, even with Michael Taylor in at center field instead of Adam Eaton. Ryan Zimmerman has somehow transformed himself back into the hitter he used to be. Anthony Rendon has started hitting, as evidenced by his six-hit, three-home-run game against the Mets the other night. Trey Turner is up, and Jason Wirth and Daniel Murphy. I mean, it's a murderer's row. Oh, and by the way, Bryce Harper has turned back into 2015 Bryce Harper somewhat. This is a team that maybe doesn't need Adam Eaton as badly as another team might need their 4-6 win center fielder. It definitely seems like a team that could use somebody maybe to fill in that gap if somebody comes available in midseason. But I'm not crying for the Nationals right now. They have too much talent to be too scared, even with this move, I think.
And I think the only thing I'd add is that we talked last week about Desmond Jennings. There's probably no team watching to see if Desmond Jennings stays with the Mets at the AAA team than the Washington Nationals.
Desmond Jennings, man in demand, or possibly not at all.
So we're moving on now. We talked in A Block about the big top prospect, Cody Bellinger, being called up for the Los Angeles Dodgers. Now we talk about Christian Arroyo for the San Francisco Giants.
Yeah, Arroyo is an interesting prospect. He's not crazy interesting to me. I mean, he seems like kind of he's not nearly the offensive juggernaut that Bellinger is projected to be at some point during his career, but the problem with Arroyo is he's coming up to join a Giants team, which is completely in flux. They've had terrible luck recently. I have no idea what this team is going to do over the long term, But Arroyo can hit a little bit. He can make some good contact. He's flashed some power even in his time up with the Giants so far. I just I find it a little hard to get excited about Arroyo the same way some of these other top prospects that come up do, because he seems like a very Giants player. He seems a little bit, you know, unassuming once he gets on the field. He's more of a collection of good talents, it seems like, rather than any one outstanding skill.
Yeah, I mean, Giants prospects are never really flashy, and with Arroyo, you're really talking about the hit tool, and he's probably going to become one of those boring 280-plus hitters who's actually a very valuable player, but you're not going to necessarily get excited about him or watching him play. And but Giants have had a lot of those over the years, and they've also had a lot of success, so maybe that's not a coincidence.
Yeah, I just don't feel like the world needs another Joe Panic. But that's kind of what it feels like Arroyo is. So, yeah, the Giants have them all. If only they had a left-handed top-of-the-rotation ace, but they don't have that anymore. So we'll kind of have to see how things go. But hopefully something will go right for the Giants, because things so far have been pretty ugly.
So now we shift to Aaron Nola, who was supposed to come off the DL earlier this week. He's going to be staying on it with a lower back strain that he got after a start against the New York Mets. So I assume it's like an infection thing where you play the Mets, somebody gets injured. And Nola had this to say earlier this week. It came back again. It's taking a little longer than I thought it would. Still kind of nagging. I really don't think it was a big issue. I don't think it's too much. It just kind of lasted a long time. Every day it feels a little better. I just have to stay on the right path and keep doing what the trainers have me doing.
I still like him. I know the ERA wasn't great last season, but I don't know. What do you think, Brian? Am I missing something here, or is my optimism misplaced, or what?
So Nola, from the jump, has kind of seemed like one of those guys that didn't need a lot of seasoning before making it to the majors. I think when he's on the field, he's like a solid number three starter, if not something better than that. But the continued kind of injury and then setback, and it's a back issue for a pitcher, that gets me a little, it gives me kind of a sick feeling in my stomach when I hear that. It's not as bad as Tommy John, but it's one of those things that I think might nag all season. So that concerns me. And, you know, as a recovering Mets fan, I guess, is the best way I would put it, nothing makes me happier than to see the Phillies have horrible, horrible things happen to them, but not in the case of Nola. He's so much fun to watch as a pitcher. I just I'm nervous about it, and I think that this might be something that ends up being a little bit of a bigger deal, and I think the Phillies would be wise to sit him for a little bit. I mean, after all, they're certainly not looking to compete this season.
I believe that's the plan, though, right? This is just precautionary by stretching out his disabled list stay. At least that's what I had read. I don't think this is necessarily indicative of the severity of injury so much as this them handling him with the care that they should handle a big part of their future rotation with.
So moving from the National League to the American League, we shift to a trio of injuries, or a trio of moves for the Seattle Mariners. We have Felix Hernandez to the 10-day disabled list with right shoulder inflammation. He had what they called dead arm before he was put on the disabled list. Mitch Haniger, also to the 10-day disabled list, 3 to 4 weeks with a strained right oblique. And Gene Segura has been activated for the first time this season.
I am so mystified by the Mariners and these transactional moves. I mean, the injury to Felix Hernandez, that doesn't seem like it's a big deal, because Felix Hernandez is such a wild card at this point. His performance isn't anything like the King Felix we've come to know and love over the last decade. Haniger getting injured is brutal for the Mariners. I mean, their outfield already looked weak. And Haniger was really having kind of a breakout. But Gene Segura coming back is a huge big deal for them, because now they can plug in Taylor Motter at literally any other position on the field. And apparently Motter is going to at least continue to hit a little bit. So it's the Mariners are this great enigma to me this season. I have no idea what to expect of them. This is just more shuffling the deck. And I mean, just sometime the dice are going to have to rest at some point. And I still don't know. It seems like to keep up with the random gambling metaphors, it seems like another flip of the coin as to whether or not this is going to turn out okay or not. I just I really don't know what to make of this at some point. At some point, you think this team is going to have to need some sort of stability, though, to get to the next level.
Jerry DePoto as Las Vegas degenerate actually makes quite a deal of sense when you think about his addiction to making roster moves. And you're right, this team is not in a good position right now. And, you know, adding Segura will help, but who even knows we're going to get from him? Honestly, right. He's been up and down throughout his career. And while he has a valid reason for some of that downswing with, you know, his the death of his child, I don't know. This is really not a fun team to watch right now, and it might not be a fun team to watch anytime soon, other than the days when James Paxton is starting.
Yeah, that's still a lot of fun. But with Felix, like, you know, he hasn't been himself or his old self for quite a long time, but still you don't want to run Chris Heston out there instead of him. Like, you know, you'd still rather have what's left of Felix Hernandez, I think, than some of the guys that the Mariners have in AAA to perhaps take his rotation spot. So hopefully he'll get better soon and we'll see something worthwhile from him.
So we talk about Felix has the lowest strikeout rate of his career and also the lowest walk rate, which means he's really dependent on his defense, and having a .388 BABIP hurts at this point. So maybe getting Segura back on the defensive end could help with that a little bit, as the Mariners metrics really don't like their range at all, and that has to be hurting Felix, who's more of a ground ball pitcher.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
That's a good point.
Haniger as well, batting .342, .447 OBP, and .608 slugging with a .369 TAV and 95 plate appearances.
There we have it.
So moving on now, Christian Bethencourt outrighted to AAA El Paso. The pitcher and catcher now will be looking to retool in AAA. So what does this mean for Christian Bethencourt?
It means that he's probably on his way to irrelevancy. Just to go over his numbers, he made 4 appearances this season, 3 2/3 innings, gave up 6 hits, which doesn't sound too bad considering, but he also allowed 9 runs, 6 of those earned, and a home run. And the most important statistic is that he walked 8 of the 25 batters he faced and uncorked 2 wild pitches. And realistically, he was put in an impossible situation trying to make this transition from catching full-time to pitching full-time over basically the course of 1 winter and 1 spring. You know, this is something that's going to take some time for him to develop that comfort, that rhythm. Obviously, he looked pretty good for a positional player pitching, at least so far as stuff and velocity. But, I mean, realistically, he's going to have to develop the feel that goes with throwing strikes and throwing quality strikes, and the odds are against him. I mean, it's a fun story, and hopefully he does make it back and has some success, but no one should have expected immediate success from Bethencourt.
Yeah, I very much agree with you on all counts, RJ. I think this is going to be good for him, honestly, because from what I've heard, this is going to now be a focus on converting him to full-time pitcher in AAA, which I think is probably his best bet at becoming a relevant major leaguer some other time, is to really focus on getting those reps as a relief pitcher, developing his command, developing his control, not walking every single batter he faces, and just working to make him the best possible relief pitcher he can be, because he's not going to continue to be successful as a catcher. He certainly is not going to continue to be successful as an outfielder. And the two-way player thing is really fun for people like us, but probably a lot less fun for Bethencourt and the Padres, because he's been not good at either. So I think this is going to be really good for him. I look forward to seeing him back in the Padres bullpen, hopefully in 2018, throwing some strikes every once in a while at least. And I'm rooting for him to come back. And, you know, then you can still use him as a Michael Lorenzen-esque pinch hitter once in a while if you really need to. But he's got to become a pitcher first, I feel like.
So moving on now, we have a little bit of more sad news. Shelby Miller diagnosed with a torn UCL. He's going to have to get Tommy John. So what does this mean? We talked about him last week. But what does this mean for the Diamondbacks?
It's bad. it's really bad.
I think the most interesting thing here is what they decide to do with Archie Bradley, who they had converted to the bullpen this season. I mean, if you haven't seen his numbers, he has been insanely good in the bullpen. 10.7 strikeouts per 9, 1.7 walks per 9. Has given up more than a home run per 9, but Are they going to move him back to the rotation, or are they going to allow him to continue to flourish in the bullpen and then at a later date move him to the rotation? I mean, they have a couple of options in the minors with Shipley and Banda, but if you're ever going to do it, there's no time like the present, right? With shifting Bradley back and seeing if he can carry some of this newfound success with him to the rotation, or if he's just going to be the new Wade Davis, a guy who came up as a hyped right-handed power pitching prospect, had to move to the bullpen, found some success, moved back to the rotation, didn't quite find that success, and then went on to become one of the best closers in baseball. So which path he's going to follow, I don't know. We'll find out.
It's a great question, because we all know that a starting pitcher who's even average probably has a lot more value to a team than all but the best relief pitchers. And Bradley has been one of the best recently. What would you do if you were the Diamondbacks, knowing what we know, RJ? Would you try to move him back to the rotation at this point, or would you let it ride?
Well, it's difficult because this is a team that was not necessarily expected to compete. However, they've gotten off to a good start. And when you think about it, they have that closer situation. Fernando Rodney has really been kind of Fernando Rodney-esque. And, while you're playing well, do you try to inspire your clubhouse by inserting Bradley as your closer? And then once you fade off as expected, you can maybe say, okay, we're going to bring you into the rotation as we prepare for next season and the seasons thereafter? Or do you go ahead and say, you know what? Our best bet at continuing to win is to stretch Bradley out, put him back into the rotation, and that just decimates a bullpen that really does not need to be decimated further if they're going to continue to be competitive. Because, I liked Jorge De La Rosa a lot during the winter, but if he is your best reliever or your second best reliever to J.J. Hoover, you probably have some issues there.
Yeah, and Hoover is an interesting guy because he's such a wild card. He's been pitching very well, striking out the planet this season in his limited work. He also has just the barest hints of control, and I have no idea how that's going to hold up over time. And like you said, De La Rosa's fine. Fernando Rodney isn't, and the rest of the bullpen is hot garbage. So do you decimate it by moving Mount Bradley? Do you try to get another relief pitcher from one of these other teams that's struggling at some point and then hope Bradley can adapt to the rotation? I would leave him be, and that's really tough for me to say because I'm always the guy who wants to keep a guy in the rotation until he absolutely fails. But with Banda and Shipley hopefully coming up, you can get a fourth starter out of that perhaps, whereas I just am not convinced Bradley is going to be much more than a fourth starter if you do move him out of the pen at this point. But it's a tough call. And, the Diamondbacks, whatever we think is the right thing to do, the Diamondbacks will do the other thing probably. So it doesn't matter.
They're under new management. You never know. that bullpen transition, that's kind of like a near-death experience. Some guys go through it and they come back with this new lease on life and starting. And then, again, sometimes they're Wade Davis and they get shuttled back to the bullpen pretty quickly. So we'll find out which one Bradley is in the coming weeks.
We'll call Andrew Triggs and we'll ask him for advice.
Yes.
I really hope they leave him in the bullpen. Upper 90s fastball, lower 80s knuckle curve, and just really two dominant pitches. And going forward now, we move on to the Rangers waiver claim of Pete Cosma from the New York Yankees, who was DFA'd this week. Jurickson Profar sent down as a result. So Profar batting 135. With a .289 on base percentage and .135 slugging percentage and a .196 TAV. So what does this mean for the former top prospect for the Texas Rangers?
Well, it's never a good thing when a team is picking Pete Cosma over you. And I think the biggest surprise here is not necessarily that Profar has struggled, because, given the amount of time he's missed, it's sort of expected to some extent that he won't be performing at optimal level. But the fact that he still has options remaining, I mean, it feels like he's been around the major leagues forever. I know it's like 2012 is when he made his debut. The fact that he still has an option remaining is pretty impressive, even if I understand the reasoning why. But, with Profar, he got off to a pretty good start in 2016. And we were all like, oh, see, the athleticism, the tools are still there. He's going to be just fine. And now you look at his career numbers and He's got nearly 700 big league plate appearances, and about half of these came before he missed those years, and about half came after. And there's really nothing positive there. You know, his career OPS plus is 73. He's only got 12 home runs and 22 other extra base hits. And, you know, he's an impressive athlete. The versatility is nice, but I mean, at what point do you say this is perhaps not going to happen, or at least perhaps not going to happen anytime soon? Because he still is pretty young, and, you know, maybe a full year in the minors or what have you would help, but I guess I'm starting to get concerned that Jurickson and Profar is never going to hang a star.
Yeah, it is concerning. I was expecting him to get off to a little bit of a hotter start this year, but I really didn't understand how bad he was last year, I think, until like taking a look at the end of the season and being like, wow, he really didn't hit for any power whatsoever. I mean, the on-base percentage was somewhat impressive given how little he managed to hit for average. He was able to take a few walks here and there, and that's great and everything, but he was an offensive zero. He's not the defensive player, especially, you know, you talk about his versatility. It's great to be versatile, but it's one thing to be versatile because you're not excellent at any one position versus you're a top-end shortstop who can really pick it at some of these other positions.
Yeah.
And Profar was good at first base. He was a good defensive first baseman, it felt like. But you can have plenty of good defensive first basemen who don't hit for a 221 true average. I mean, you know, you can go with just about anybody there. I would love to see him get just everyday reps in the minor leagues. He wasn't going to get any playing time with the big club, the Rangers, because they're kind of one of those teams that has a great starting lineup. And the depth is not really there, but they really want everybody to stay healthy and go with what they've got. And, you know, Beltre will come back eventually and that sort of thing. So there's not a whole lot of room for him to get these everyday reps. So I guess it's better for him to be in the minor leagues. But I'm starting to think he's a change of scenery guy. If anything's going to come of this, it's going to be with another franchise.
Yeah, we heard rumors during the offseason that I believe the Padres had some interest and the Rays had some interest because, you know, that's what the Rays need is another former top infield prospect who hasn't necessarily lived up to his hype at the major league level. But yeah, I kind of agree with you that he's not going to necessarily get that opportunity in Texas, and it might be best for his career if they do use him to acquire another piece either now at a deadline or this winter.
Here's just one quick thing. You mentioned the Rays. Who would you rather have as part of your franchise at this point? Would you rather have Jurickson Profar, or would you rather have Tim Beckham?
Oh, man. See, here's the thing about Tim Beckham. If you look at his career numbers, and I realize, you know, he's been platooned and, you know, what have you, and it's still a small sample, but he's actually been like a league average hitter for his career. Whereas Profar, like, there's nothing there statistically. Like you said, he hit for no average. He did walk, but walk can't be your only hustle, man.
Like, right.
So, yeah, Tim Beckham from a performance standpoint is like the clear choice here. And the only reason I'm hesitating is because, I mean, I guess I'm just hesitating because I'm remembering how hype Profar was. And like, he was supposed to be like this elite level shortstop, whereas Beckham's star kind of faded quickly. And it wasn't due to injury. It was due to his performance and his tools receding. Whereas with Profar, I guess there's this hesitation in me to be like, oh, you know, the injuries have sapped all that, even though I'm naturally conservative about injury prone players. So that's a toughie. But I mean, if you're just going off performance, which is only thing that matters at the major league level, I guess you would have to say Tim Beckham, wouldn't you?
Isn't that so? But it's so bizarre to think like that because Beckham has the reputation of being this, you know, enormous bust. But actually, he's played pretty well this year. He's got four homers and so far on the season, and he, like you've said, he's hit for enough power in his time in the majors that he's been just a fine hitter. Not anything super special, but a fine hitter. And Profar has just been, I mean, he's been garbage at the plate. So it's, yeah, you know, Beckham's got 3 years on him. It's just such a weird thing to even consider. Like, you would take this guy who is famous for being such a mistake over Profar, who is famous for being such a highly touted number one overall prospect.
Yeah, and Beckham is, I mean, I know we're not talking about Beckham as the main topic here, but he is kind of interesting in the sense that you know, even this year he got off to a slow start, and he's never going to walk a lot. You know, he's an aggressive swinger, but the power is legitimate. Like, if he gets enough playing time, he's going to have double-digit home runs. He might threaten 20 if he gets significant playing time. I mean, for his career, he has 18 and 532 plate appearances. I don't know what the deal was with Matt Duffy. I don't know how long. I mean, since they've acquired him, he's seemingly been a lost cause where it comes to injuries. I don't know what he's going to do when he comes back performance-wise, but it's pretty nice to see Tim Beckham kind of fortify himself as a legitimate shortstop option this season, even though it probably won't last. He's probably not going to continue to have a 125 OPS plus because he's not going to continue to hit 272. But yeah, it's nice. It's a nice story so far for a team that doesn't necessarily have a lot of nice stories.
Yeah, the last off-topic Tim Beckham fact that I'll throw at you, 11 triples in 532 plate appearances.
See, that's interesting too, because you don't think of him as a burner. He has 6 career stolen bases and 8 tries. So he's not, you know, this is not Billy Hamilton here.
6 stolen bases, 11 triples in almost a season, and so far afield from the original topic of Pete Cosma and Jerickson Profar.
Nobody wants to talk about Pete Cosma. Pete Cosma doesn't even want to talk about Pete Cosma.
No, not at all.
Moving on down the road now, Boston claimed Chase Darnot from Atlanta. Darnot was DFA'd earlier this week. It'll be the 4th organization for the 2008 fourth rounder.
Let's talk about Pete Cosma.
Like, is Pete Cosma actually more interesting than Chase Darnot?
I mean, it's close, isn't it? It's really close, and that's not necessarily a great thing for Chase Darnot. I guess the most interesting thing I have to say about Chase Darnot is that when you begin a sentence with his last name, do you capitalize the D?
Never. Never. As a former editor for a Mets-related site with their own Darnot, you got to leave it low. Leave it low all the time.
You got to leave it low. Okay.
Leave it low.
Good life advice. Yeah. Good life advice. Now, Brian, I believe you did have a point to make here about how the Red Sox are using the last spot on their bench. Am I correct about that?
Yeah. I think it's really interesting because the last piece on the bench for the Red Sox tends to be somebody we don't expect to see playing for a team that's, you know, among the top elite teams in the American League. I mean, now they've got Chase Darnot on their 25-man roster. They've had a guy like Steve Selsky at the back of their 25-man roster. Josh Rutledge is a little bit of a different issue, and Marco Hernandez, those guys are kind of taking on some roles because of the injuries to Brock Holt and to Pablo Sandoval. But they kind of are running the back end of their bench seems to be guys who are – how do I put this nicely? Not good enough to be on the Red Sox with a team that's supposed to be, you know, competing for, you know, maybe 100 wins, maybe to really go far in the playoffs this year. You'd really think that even despite the injuries, they'd be running some guys out there as bench options who are just of a little bit higher quality than these replacement level sort of players like Selsky and Darnot. The fact that the Red Sox need a Chase Darnot is perhaps an indictment of this team. I'd be really interested to see if there's another move that they need to make where they acquire somebody who's not a former Atlanta Braves poor utility guy. But I'm just kind of surprised the way this team has kind of gone about their roster construction so far.
It kind of sounds like we're talking about the old Yankees here, where we're like, this team is really good. They spent a lot of money, and yet look at their bench. You know, you remember those days where, I mean, it was during the late 90s and early 2000s where we were constantly talking about how, wow, this is what $200 million gets you, huh? You know?
Right.
And if you look at the Red Sox depth chart in AAA, it's not necessarily going to get better. They have Alan Craig, who, yeah, no there. Matt Dominguez is still around, so that's inspiring. Rosny Castillo is, yeah, he's not going to get the call. And then Devin Marrero is the ever name you would recognize there, unless you're a Brian Bogusevic fan. He is still around, so that's encouraging as well.
There probably is a Brian Bogusevic fan somewhere out there.
Oh, and while we're talking about weird fandoms, Junior Lake. Do you remember when Kevin Goldstein used to have to fend off Junior Lake questions like every other day? Because when Lake just looked like a tremendous ball player until you actually got to the baseball playing part.
Yeah.
So he is also a member of the Red Sox Paul Tuckett team. It's good to know.
So lots of guys with the former MLB experience, none of them very good. So poor Red Sox. We're not crying over the Red Sox right now, but still, you think maybe there's something else that has to happen.
Yes.
My guess is Brock Holt is now in a rehab assignment. My guess is that Chase Arnaud is kind of a holdover, maybe?
Yeah, I would have to imagine that's the case. But, you know, they could have easily brought up Marrero instead of going out and acquiring Darno. So I would assume they've got some more of a long-term plan where they want him around as a backup over some of those other guys. But, yeah, hopefully the Chase Darno era is short and sweet and over immediately.
Brock Holt, the only good portion of the Joel Hanrahan trade. So moving forward, Sean Mania now on the 10-day DL with a left shoulder strain. That move retroactive to April 27th. He had a 5.18 ERA this season, but a 1.75 DRA in 24 and a third innings pitched.
Yeah, I want to talk about him because I have some numbers here. And just for perspective, last season he threw 144 and two-thirds innings. This season he's thrown 24 and a third innings. But let me just hit you with some statistics that are concerning to me and that would seem to be explained by his injury. Last season he walked 6.2% of the batters he faced. This season it's 11.4%. But it even goes beyond that. His strike percentage has dropped from 67.1%, which is well above MLB average, down to 59.1%. And last season, he issued 6 four-pitch walks all year. This year, he's already issued 4. And very last one for you, because I'm on his baseball reference page, if we're being honest. But last season, he hit 4 batters and uncorked 3 wild pitches all year. This season, he's already hit 4 batters, and he's already thrown a wild pitch. So if you're the Oakland Athletics, you have to hope that this shoulder strain has impacted his command and control, because while he's still missing bats and striking batters out, it's very hard to be effective when you're just completely unable to locate the baseball. And hopefully it's nothing severe, because he is fun to watch. But yeah, when he returns, I think the Athletics are hoping he returns with a little bit more control than he's shown thus far this season.
Yeah, I love watching Manea pitch. I really am perhaps like a little bit higher on him than most because his stuff's so much fun. But yeah, this is a bad run of things for the Athletics. I mean, Andrew Triggs aside, losing Manea and now and Graveman as well. Things were already a little dicey in Oakland, but this is not helping anybody. I really hope he comes back soon and effective, but I just don't know what you're talking about with the control issues are concerning.
Yoenis Cespedes, the 10-day disabled list, talked about him last week. He now has a left hamstring strain. So, Brian, I'm going to toss it up, and then I'm going to run immediately. What are your thoughts?
It's bad. Every injury that takes place is bad. The Mets have run Cespedes out there despite being not entirely healthy, and now he's badly injured, the same hamstring. So, you know, the Mets are idiots when it comes to this injury thing. It makes me angry all the time because they seem to make injuries worse consistently. However, maybe there's a silver lining to this in that now I think the Mets are going to be forced to play Michael Conforto every day in left field, where it's his, probably his best and most likely overall position. And Michael Conforto is the closest thing to Yoenis Cespedes on the Mets roster, and they weren't playing him as consistently as they could have been with Cespedes healthy. So maybe this isn't the biggest blow for the Mets. Maybe it'll be nice that they actually will have to get him healthy by putting him on the disabled list, and then they'll have a healthy Cespedes back later on. But, I mean, just knock it off already, Mets. At least we'll see some Conforto, but just stop. Just this season should just end today for the Mets, and we should all just go home.
I don't have anything to add to that, but Brian, I think you need help. You sound very defeated, and it's May 1st. You have months and months more of Mets baseball to go. You need to start meditating or something, you know, clean your chakras.
I think that's really helpful. I think I'll do that once we hear what the status of Noah Syndergaard's lat will be. and then maybe I'll be able to breathe easy again. But probably not.
Drink a lot of water.
The New York Mets, just like we expected, being led by Michael Conforto and Jay Bruce. So Ian Desmond activated from the 10-day disabled list. What does this mean for a Rockies lineup that has been hitting very well this season?
It should be good. I mean, you know, Desmond was their big free agent signing of the winter. And, you know, the fun thing here, the fun thing about that team, and it's no disrespect to Ian Desmond, is we get to talk about Mark Reynolds. Who would have thought that we'd be talking at all about Mark Reynolds in a positive sense in 2017? Because remember when they signed Reynolds, it was like, oh, they actually signed a real first baseman now. And to his credit, he's played very well. But yeah, I mean, you know, Ian Desmond, I don't know what to expect there. He was so good the first half of last season, was so not good the second half of last season. He should hit in Coors Field, but I'm still confused about a lot of what went on with that signing and a lot of what they expected and what they projected. And I guess I'm curious to see how it plays out, but it should be a boost for a team that, you know, has had some injury woes lately. It could use a boost.
Yeah. The most interesting thing for me is that Ian Desmond's first game back, he played left field and they left Mark Reynolds in the lineup, and Mark Reynolds went 0-for-4 with a walk, which is fine because that's every other Mark Reynolds game. And, you know, you just have to hold out those games in hopes of the ones where he gets the big dingers. But they put Desmond in left field, and I, quite frankly, with the injuries that they've had, with the, you know, Carlos Gonzalez in right field, Blackman in center, left field is Desmond's best position. The problem everyone had with the Ian Desmond signing over the offseason was the idea of playing him at first base. And if you're going to put him in the outfield in a corner where he's actually okay defensively and he's maybe a league average hitter, he's a pretty good left fielder. He may not be worth what the Rockies paid him, but he's a pretty good left fielder. And if you move him to first base for the games when you don't want to face Reynolds with a really solid platoon advantage or something like that, this could be a nice fit for the Rockies, the National League West leading Rockies. It's weird to say. I don't know how long this is going to hold out, but it's nothing but a good thing for the Rockies, nothing but a good thing for Desmond. And quite honestly, I'd kind of like it if he plays really well, because he probably took a lot of crap over the offseason, over the absolute strangeness of this signing. And so him playing well would probably be a nice thing.
Yeah, and I guess the question is, what do you do when David Dahl returns, and what do you do when Raimel Tapia is ready for the show? That was another reason why we all kind of questioned that, because the Rockies seem to be positioned to trade Carlos Gonzalez or to trade Charlie Blackman. They didn't trade either of them, so a clustered outfielder it was going to get more clustered with Desmond playing the outfield, and now it is again, but I don't know. Maybe they just didn't have confidence in Dahl's health, and this was sort of a sneaky way of covering for that without admitting such in the public eye. But hard to say, and I guess we'll just have to see how this one plays out. Plus, I mean, this is a team that signed Gerardo Parra last winter, too. So, you know, they like their outfielders. They really do.
So I think the only other thing more shocking about the National League West is that it's led by the Rockies and Diamondbacks. And Brian, do you want to do the Syndergaard thing? I don't know if you just got that update.
Oh, no. Oh, God. What was the update? You can share it with us.
Headed to the disabled list, partial tear of right lat muscle, no timetable for return. The best Mets thing you could ever hear. And then he will be placed in the 10-day.
Yeah, okay. So breaking news, absolutely breaking news. Not breaking to anybody who's listening this. Noah Syndergaard's broken. It's time for the Mets to take a deep breath and play as hard as you can for the next month. And then when it comes time to June, sell off your Jay Bruce and your Curtis Granderson and your Juris Familia pieces and maybe wave the white flag for 2017. I know it's early, but this is horrible.
I have nothing to add, but again, these Mets fans are – they're in for a long one.
I mean, I don't like to get all Panic City on everyone. And I really do think, you know, the team is so deep that they can do very, very well if only a couple of things break right. But Sean Gilmartin is now the number 5 starter. and you need something to break right at some point. And honestly, the best thing that's happened to the Mets so far this season is Jay Bruce hitting like an all-star, because maybe they can turn him into something worthwhile at the deadline, since they have too many outfielders anyway. But no, this is terrible news. Syndergaard was one of the best pitchers to watch in baseball, and even if you're not a Mets fan, you got to miss being able to watch him take the bump every 5 days.
He's a video game character. I mean, he's what you create when you get the video game—a huge dude with huge stuff. Who, I mean, I wouldn't create him with a long hair, but other than that, yeah, he is absolutely what you would create.
Absolutely. So yeah, I think that's a strong point on which to end the show for today. I'm going to go cry into my coffee. I don't know if everybody else is going to do the same thing, but I think this was a fun show despite the impending terror of continued injuries this early in the season. Sean, RJ, anything else you want to add before we call it a day?
No, I think we're both ready to retreat to existential doom. I can't even talk now. That's how torn up I am about Thor.
I'm right there with you.
All right. So thank you very much for listening and for joining us on the DFA podcast. Again, you can find RJ at cbssports.com. You can find myself at baseballprospectus.com and Sean at bpmets and beyondtheboxscore.com. Again, we are in the process of getting everything set up for the show, but you can always email us at dfa@baseballprospectus.com. You can find us on Twitter at DFA Podcast, and we will be back later in the week with another show. Thanks for joining us.